For the past 5 weeks, we've been working our way through a sermon series where we're considering and discussing the thinking question, the questions that thinking people ask. Okay, these are the existential, the life-changing questions. And we started out talking about God and science, and we looked at science and we realized how science has a way of taking away the need for God. And then after that, we looked at Christian hypocrisy and all the things that happen among our own people that are a detriment to spreading the love of God. We talked about violence and war, and we talked about the troubling scriptures that are out there, scriptures that we read that we really need help interpreting. Last week, we talked about pain and suffering, and the big question there is, how with a loving God, a compassionate God, can there be so much pain and suffering in our world? And as we've gone through each of these things, we've looked at them, and we've looked at the what's happening in our society, in our world, and we've also made small arguments along the way how we as believers deal with these things and work with these things. Well, today we come to the closing sermon in this sermon series, and in this sermon series, we're gonna look at why some of us, in the face of all these other issues, why some of us still believe in God, and what are our reasons for doing that. So really today what we're looking at, it's me standing here before you expressing the best I can why I believe in God, why I can make an argument for it, and what those reasons are. This is not complete. You have your own reasons. You have understanding too, so you can add to this list, and that's exactly what you should be doing. But I want to begin this morning recognizing something that Harry Emerson Fosdyke said in his book, Dear Mr. Brown. Dear Mr. Brown is a little book, and it's a series of letters between a skeptic, a struggling young man, and a pastor. And these letters go back and forth, and they talk about some of the very things that we've been talking about. But in being perplexed by religion, this is one of Harry Emerson Fosdyke's responses to this young man. He says, some people who disbelieve in God are really disbelievers in some particular idea of God. You have in your mind a picture of God that makes belief in him difficult, if not impossible. This may very probably be a major factor in your problem with faith. Men use the word God continually, but with varied pictures and ideas about him in their minds. Then he said something that, this next line, you've probably heard this before because it's been repeated over and over again, but it was Harry Emerson Fosdyke that originally said it in Dear Mr. Brown. He says, tell me about the God that you don't believe in. I may not believe in him either. That's a very profound statement that he just made there. And what I want to say is, you know, if we are talking about images of God, if your God is an angry old man that's ready to strike, if your God is one who gives cancer to children, if your God is one who is afraid of modern science, if your God is one who tells people to fly airplanes into buildings, I don't believe in that God either. But if you tell me your God is the one who is represented in Jesus Christ, I absolutely believe in that God. And I follow that God. And I just want you to consider today some of the compelling reasons that I think I have for believing in that God too. In that bulletin that you picked up on the way in, there's a set of sermon notes in there that's kind of an outline to the sermon today. If you're following along and something hits you, take that pencil in the pew and just write it down there so that later when you take a look at it, you can remember that. You know, and the reason we do this is if you're like me, if you don't write it down, you don't remember it. And I always hope that God speaks to us in church. There's something that God says to us here. Okay, I want to start off with a very basic premise, all right? And I want to suggest this to you. If you do not believe in God, that decision to not believe is as much a decision of faith as a decision to believe in God. It takes faith to decide not to believe in God, the same as it takes faith to decide to believe in God. Because what you find is you find arguments on both sides. You find arguments on both sides of this, and what you have to do is you look at the evidence, and you look at that, and you say, I believe or I don't believe. Now, me, when I look at the evidence, I'm compelled to believe that there is a God. There's a much greater body of evidence, I feel, on one side than the other when you take a close look at it. The world, however, would like to convince you that there's no God. The world sees it differently, and in the last 6 weeks, in all these sermons, all these discussions that we've been having, I've been talking about sources of faith and trying to convince you that it's elsewhere. Okay, so when I think, really what I'm doing here today is I'm making a case, I'm stating reasons for the existence of God. And when I talk about the existence of God, three things come to mind. So I'm going to really try and work out these three things with you. Three very broad categories. And that first category is the phenomenon of nature. Okay, we heard in Psalm 8 this morning, the psalmist says, "When I consider the stars and the heavens, O God, how majestic is your name." All right, it was obvious. Unless it was within the past couple hundred years, before that, when people looked at creation, when they looked up the stars, when they saw these things, they're saying, wow, there must be some incredible, intelligent creature. There must be a God who created all of these things. But it's only been in the last couple hundred years with the advent of science that we look at these things and we say, well, science is discussing the origins of our universe. It talks about complex life here on the planet. It's starting to reason away why there would be a God, why there would be a creator, okay? So we don't really need a God to explain these things. We have science, and science can take place of God. And there's really two major themes here, two major theories. And we all got these in high school. And for me, I remember starting way back in elementary school, way back in the early 70s, late 60s, you know, and one of those is that story of complex life, which is evolutionary theory. And the other part, portion of that is the origin of our universe, or the Big Bang theory. These are the two, the existence of the universe and complex life form, these are the two theories that we find that are primary in science right now that explain these things, okay? And they explain a lot of wonderful things, the mechanics, and I love science. You know, I went to, earth and mineral sciences. That's what I studied. I love these things. But with these prevailing models, I look at these and they raise a lot of questions for me. They are not set in stone. There's a lot of things there that we do that. And I have to be honest with you. When I go back and go through evolutionary theory, I look at the Big Bang theory, they increase my sense of awe and my wonder for God. They don't push me away from God. They draw me closer to God. How wonderful it is that we have this creator that can set these laws into motion. I can make this happen. It's absolutely amazing, you know? And the Big Bang Theory is one of those things. The Big Bang Theory, proposed by a Catholic priest, by the way, says that 14 billion years ago, there was singularity. This is a marble, probably about the size of a dime. The Big Bang Theory says that from singularity, this one point, everything else that exists came from this. There was something happened inside of singularity. Everything that created the stars and the moons and everything that's on our planet exploded out of this. And 14 billion years ago, when that exploded, it started expanding, and it still expands today. It all comes from this. But when I read Big Bang Theory, when I look at it, I say, well, what was singularity in the midst of? Who lit the fuse on singularity? I mean, our laws tell us that for every action, there was another action that caused the action, because that's the way our world works. So what was the action that caused singularity to explode and expand? I mean, these are great questions that we can think about. What was it in the midst of? What happened? It didn't come from nowhere. We knew it was in the midst of somewhere. What was it doing? Whatever happens, there's another reaction. These are just some of the questions that I come up with when I think about the Big Bang Theory and thinking about evolutionary theory, life evolving on our planet. I find the theory of evolution to be a wonderful thing, and it's wonderful to look at and study in these processes that life goes through here on our planet. But I wonder, how did all of those elements come together, again, out of singularity? How did they all come out of here to create this incredibly amazing life that we have here? And that cell, how did the amino acids come together to form that first cell? And where did that cell's software come from? Okay, so it's given that software, and then it's able to reproduce itself. How did it come together to form that very first multicellular organism? And when did we human beings gain consciousness, by the way? What was that all about, and how did that happen? When I think about these things, it all leads me towards a creator. It leads me towards something very intelligent that put these things together and put them into motion. All right, so I look at these things and I start to ask the questions. And you know something, not only theologians ask these questions, but scientists ask these questions too. Fred Hoyle, I introduced you to Fred Hoyle way back in our first sermon in this series. He's a Cambridge astronomer who was an atheist. And Fred Hoyle, in his study of carbon-based life forms, what he was looking at how rare carbon is in the universe. And he was trying to figure out how are we blessed on the planet Earth with carbon the way that we have it. And what he said this: a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with the physics as well as with the chemistry and biology and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to be so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question. What conclusion? The conclusion is that there's a super intellect that's monkeying with the laws of our planet that allowed these things to happen so we could be here. And Fred Hoyle was the one, if you remember the illustration, Fred Hoyle was the one that wrote the illustration about there being a junkyard and a tornado and a hurricane sweep through. And once the tornado and the hurricane sweep through, everybody comes out of the houses, and sitting where the junkyard used to be is a perfectly formed Boeing 747, ready to operate. I think those odds are pretty small. So that's where Fred Hoyle was in that place. So when I think about this, I think about that little marble, you know, and I think about this room. I think about this beautiful room that we come and we worship in. And I can accept the fact that out of this singularity, the wood and the brick and the stone and the metal, it all comes out of there. But what I do understand is when this place was built in the 1960s, there was a few architects and a few planners and a few engineers involved, and they had to make the plans, and it took them a long time to do that. And then what they did is they got a contractor. The contractor came and interpreted their plans, and over a period of time, we have this beautiful room. But I have a really tough time thinking that out of this singularity was also created the life and the purpose that takes place inside of this room every time it's used. I have a very hard time accepting that. That raises a lot of questions, a lot of questions. And I think about music. I think about a scientist and a theologian sitting down and they hear this beautiful music like we've just heard this morning, absolutely incredible. And the scientist says, hey, I can tell you all about that. I'm like, great, I want to know about that. He says, well, when your man Eric strikes the keys, you know, that key, there's a little hammer that hits a string, and that string vibrates, and then that vibration creates a sound wave that goes through the air, and it gets to your ear, and it touches an auditory nerve, and that auditory nerve sends a message to your brain, and your brain says, hey, music, right? I say, wow, that's wonderful. And the same thing with the trumpets that play here, the brass that plays here once a month, you know? So I go over, and I sit down at the piano, and I play my best Beethoven, right? Bah, 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 you know? I'm like, that's what the scientist is talking about. He's talking about noise. But it takes a composer. It takes somebody putting the notes together in the right order, in the right timing, at the right place, in the right sequence. And you come up with these incredible things that we hear. And when that noise does reach the auditory nerve and it goes into our brain, there's joy. And there's an emotional response to it. How can the scientist explain that? All right, so there's so much more to this whole thing about creation than what we really talk about here. And you know, when I think about what the scientist is talking about, it's the mechanics. But when I talk about what the theologian is talking about, it's the composer that puts it all together into this wonderful story. I love what Madeleine L'Engle. Madeleine L'Engle, you'll probably remember, she wrote a lot of children's books. That's what she's known for. But she said this in one of her books. She said, all that the new discoveries of science can do is to enlarge our knowledge of the magnitude and glory of God's creation. Science and theology need each other. That's a children's book. That's great stuff. All right, that was the first one, phenomenon of nature. That's the first reason for the existence of God. The second one is the way I think about you, the way I think about human beings, and the way I think about God. When I think about human beings, I think about who am I? I think about who are you? I think about how I experience myself. I think about the feelings that I have. I think about the reasoning that I do, the different relationships that move in and out of my life. And when I think about God and other people, I sometimes find myself feeling anger, joy, love. I feel all these different things. I have a sense of right and wrong inside of me, who I am, who I am not. And as a Christian and a theologian, I believe that I have a soul. I think there's something more to me than just a heart beating, all right, and tissue, flesh. I think there's another part of me that's not physical. Now, what the world would have you believe is all the things that I just said, feelings, relationship, all those things, those are synapses, and they're reactions and chemicals in your brain via electrical impulses. And what the world would tell you is, you know, those are just all sensations in your brain. It has nothing to do with a body or a soul. It has nothing to do with those things. You're actually a bio-machine. You're a bio-computer. And those things that you call feelings, well, those are just things that are clicking off in your brain millions of times per fraction of a second, okay? And when I think about this, I think, wow, I think I'm more than that. I have a capacity to reason and a capacity to understand. And what they're saying is there's no me beyond me. There's no you beyond you. It's just the flesh and that incredibly complex computer that's in your head. Okay? So people ask the question, well, Tom, Pastor Tom, what evidence do you have for the existence of the soul? And I go back to another book, Viktor Frankl. Some of you were probably required to read this one in college. If you took psychology classes there, you would have to read A Man's Search for Meaning. This is the story of Viktor Frankl. He and his family were arrested and put in the concentration camps in Nazi Germany. And Viktor Frankl finds himself putting all of his skills as a psychiatrist to use, watching other people, watching himself. And he gets to this point when he's out in the yard and he's got a pickaxe in his hand and he sees death all around him and he says, I was struggling to find a reason for my sufferings, my slow dying. In a last violent protest against the hopelessness of imminent death, I sensed my spirit piercing through the enveloping the gloom. I felt it transcend the hopeless, meaningless world, and somewhere I heard a victorious yes in answer to my question of the existence of the ultimate purpose. He described how life for the prisoners, once they had given up hope, they were sure to die. But those who had hope found a reason to go on. They found a reason to keep living. And then in his book, he quotes Nietzsche. He says this. He says, Nietzsche said, he who has a why to live for can bear almost any how. He who has a why to live for can bear almost any how. And that struck me. A purpose for living. If people have a purpose and they find hope in that purpose and they find meaning in their lives, which is the theory behind Viktor Frankl's book, if they have that, they can survive anything. They can survive anything. We have a need. We have a longing for purpose. The best business person out there will tell you, you know, you don't hire people and you give them a big paycheck to give them meaning. You give them purpose. And from that comes an incredible movement. People long to have that purpose, that meaning inside. That void inside for meaning is a gift from God. And God designed that in you. He designs that in everyone, whether you're a believer or not, to find that meaning in your life. And in that meaning, you find hope. And you find purpose. And you move forward. You were created that way. You were created for purpose. You were created for God to pursue you, to help you fulfill that purpose. There was another book, The Anatomy of Hope. It's a small book by Dr. Jerome Groopman, and in there he said, hope, I have come to believe, is as vital to our lives as the very oxygen that we breathe. You have a need for hope. And, you know, Dr. Groopman goes on in his book, and he talks about, you know, it comes to a point where the doctors can give you all the hope they can through science and medicine, but there comes a point where they can't give you hope anymore. And when that happens, where do you find your hope? You find your hope in God. What fills that void inside, that purpose, that meaning, that hope can only come from God because God is that source. You're made that way. You're built that way. You're designed that way. And you know, we're wired with a conscience. We have a conscience inside that tells us, the truth is, we're not programmed very well by our parents and the culture, but God programmed us to know anyway what's right or wrong. And we know that. And sometimes it's shame or guilt that says that's wrong. You got to go do right. You got to do this. But we are programmed. We're moral agents. And we're all independent. Inside, we have that choice to make. Where did that come from? You know? And the truth is, we have that sense inside us. And evolution, some people say, oh, that's just a remnant of your evolutionary process. But evolution tells us in the survival of the fittest, the one who produces the most wins. But yet me, I say, I'm in a covenant relationship with my wife. That's wrong. Can't do that. So where did that sense come from? It obviously didn't come from evolution. It came from somewhere else. It's counterintuitive to what evolution says. Or better yet, you know, why do we have this call to go help the struggling and the weak and the needy? There is no evolutionary advantage to us helping the weak in our society. And I'll tell you what, these people who came up here today, next Saturday, what they're going to do is they're all going to get up really, really early, and they're going to get on a bus and go to the airport, and then they're going to spend 5 hours on a plane going over 2,000 miles down to Costa Rica. When they get off the plane, they get on a bus, and they go over the mountains in a bus, which is about 4.5 hours, sleep in bunk beds, get up the next day, jump in a truck, and go 2 more hours to where they can do their work. Why would they waste that energy, let the wear and tear occur in their bodies, spend the money, give up the time to go down there and give some housing to some people who need housing, some shoes to people who need shoes, and help feed the hungry? Where does that come from? There's no evolutionary benefit to that. And who here gives blood? I give blood. You know, you give blood. Why would you take an hour off work and go lay down on a table somewhere, let somebody stick a needle in your arm, which kind of hurts, if you honest me, and you'd like to wheel a little squishy ball, and let somebody take blood out of you, which you need to live, and give to somebody else? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense at all. Where does that come from? I say it's the existence of God who formed a soul in you that helps you understand there's something bigger, there's something better. You have mental capacities and feelings that move counter to everything that science tells us there. And even it gets you to the point where you're willing to lay down your life for somebody. You will die so somebody else can live. I know that about every one of you. There's somebody or some reason or something that you would die for. Okay? Folks, that is the mark. That is the image of God inside of you. It's inside of every one of us. And I don't think that happened through the theory of evolution. All right, that was the second one. The third one is experiences of God. I think we all experience God. Actually, in society, if you look at the history of humankind, every society has looked to a greater being. They not only looked to thinking that that was a creator, but they thought they experienced that being, that there was a relationship that went back and forth. Okay? They all had different names. They weren't the same names. But then you get to the point where we get to a people who gave that God a name. That God was Yahweh. It was 3,600 years ago. Okay? And they had that very same experience, that very same relationship. And the Bible is the story of those experiences of God. Adam and Eve, what did they do? They walked in the coolness of the afternoon with God. I have no idea what that means, but whatever it was a profound experience of God. Then you got this guy Abraham living in living at the bottom of the Fertile Crescent. You know, God comes to Abraham and says, Abraham, leave everything that you're familiar with, take your family and all your belongings and go all this distance. I'm giving you a new land. Abraham does it. He left behind everything that was familiar, but he had an experience with God that took him to that place. Okay? And then he says, Abraham, look up in the sky. Look at all those stars. Look at that up there. Isn't that amazing? Abraham, I'm telling you right now that your descendants will outnumber those stars, and you are blessed to be a blessing, and they are blessed to be a blessing. And who are you? Abraham's descendants. You're part of the story. You're the blessing. And then it goes on, you know, beyond that you have Moses. Moses had a profound experience with God in a burning bush that didn't consume itself. Moses, pick up everything you got, leave your goats behind, and I want you to go talk to the Pharaoh in Egypt and tell him to let my people go. People are going to laugh at you, they're going to think you're crazy, and you might get killed. He does it. He does it. I can't. Okay, then the prophets come along, and the prophets, they can't not preach. There's ills in their society. God says, preach, preach, and they can't keep it inside. They go and preach, and they're ridiculed. Some of them are killed. They gave their lives for it. Jesus comes along, he hears God, he has this experience coming up from his baptism, this is my son in whom I am well pleased. And that gives him strength, and he goes to the mountaintop for these other experiences with God, and he journeys to the cross. The Apostle Paul comes, and he has an experience of temporary blindness, and he goes from being the world's biggest persecutor to the world's biggest preacher. He's the best missionary we've ever had. He had an experience with God. I think we can all experience God. We all have that opportunity if we're willing to turn off the TV and the computer and sit down and listen and spend some time in that quiet place. I think I have experiences with God all the time. If I think about it, I'm willing to do that. I think, God, I'm experiencing him every day. I remember at my last church, this probably goes back 8 years or so, it was a busy season. I was in church, and I kept getting this nudge to go visit this lady who was on hospice at her home, and I kept getting this nudge. I said, Kim, I know it's busy. It's the holidays. I got to go visit. I got to go see her. So I go to see her, and I walk into the house, and as soon as I walk into the bedroom where she was, the daughter comes over to me and goes, oh, Pastor Tom, I'm so glad you got my message. Mom just died like 45 seconds ago. Like, I didn't get a message. She said, I called your office. I said, well, it's Sunday, you know. I don't get too many messages on Sunday. And then we sat down around that bed with Mom in the middle, and we talked about the holy ground that we were on and the effects that God has in our lives and how holy that space was and how we're going to celebrate her life. And I walked out of that place saying, thank you, God, for the incredible timing of yours that's always perfect. And there's experience after experience after experience if we're willing to slow down and feel that nudge of God in our lives. Okay, it's there. It's there for all of us. And I'll tell you what, I'll guarantee you, there's a lot of you that sit here today and say, I remember a time I picked up the phone and called so-and-so because I was nudged to do it. And the person on the other end said, I'm so glad you called. I was just thinking about you. And I'll tell you what, even if you're not a faithful person, if you don't believe in that, God is still using you because you've still had those experiences and it still happens. Okay? The scriptures tell us we're created with a soul. The scriptures tell us that God is there. He's part of our life. And the last thing I want to say here as far as the evidence in this area goes is the life-changing experiences that happen when we become faithful people. Lee Strobel, some of you know who Lee Strobel is. He was an atheist. He's an award-winning political editor for the Chicago Tribune. And Lee Strobel, as an atheist, set out on a project to prove that there was no God. He wanted evidence that said Christ is not God and did not exist and all these things. So Lee Strobel, he wrote the book. He wrote the book several years ago. Some of you have read it, The Case for Faith. In 2017, it was made into a movie, but it was called The Case for Christ. Okay? And at the end of Lee's book, The Case for Faith, Lee talks about this story of William Neal Moore. And he goes and he talks to William Neal Moore. Now, William Neal Moore is a pastor, a small church in the projects in Rome, Georgia. And he goes to talk to William Neal Moore, but he gets his history. William Neal Moore was not always a pastor. He wasn't always a nice guy. Going way back, decades ago, he was a drug dealer and a drug user. And he knew of a lady in his hometown who was known to have a lot of cash. So William Neal Moore needed a fix, and he went to her house to rob her, and he robbed her. Took $5,600, but in the struggle, he shot her too. The police came. It wasn't very hard to track down William Neal Moore. They had a trail right to him, you know, and they got him, and they put him in jail, and William Neal Moore found himself on death row. And while he was there on death row, somebody came in and talked to William Neal Moore, and they said, William, do you know that there's a God who loves you? Do you know that there's a God who sent his son to die for you so that you might have life? And you know something? William, even though everybody hates you right now, there's nobody here that likes you and loves you. There's a God that does, that longs for you, that's reaching out for you, that's like a father saying, I want you to come home. I want you to be part of my life. And William Neal Moore turned and said, I need that. He said, God, I trust you. Jesus, would you come in? Would you break me down? Would you take me away? Would you save me from myself? And there was a change in William Neal Moore's life. William Neal Moore became known on that cell block as the peacemaker. He started to talk to those hardened criminals about what happened in his life. He started praying for the guards and the rest of the people on the block. He started praying for those families. And that whole prison changed over the change in one man's life. People on the outside began to hear the stories of William Neal Moore and what were happening, and an effort came forward, and eventually there was a stay of execution. Right before he was to be killed, there was a stay in execution. And at his next parole board meeting, he sat before the parole board, and the people looked at him and asked him questions, and they said, the fingerprints say this is William Neal Moore, but it's not the same man. And he was released from prison, became a pastor, still doing it today. So Lee Strobel says, I got to go interview this guy. So he goes down, and he's talking to William Neal Moore, and he goes in, and he's totally serious. And he talks to William Neal Moore, and he goes, Bill, I got to ask this question. He says, I need to know, was it the medication they were giving you in the prison that helped this radical change in your life? Was it the therapy that they prescribed for you that you went through over and over again? Was it the programs that they helped you get back to work and do things that changed your life? William Neal Moore laughed in his face. He said, Lee, none of those things can change me. There's only one thing that can change who I am from the inside out, and that's Jesus Christ. He said, you know that, Lee. He said, only Jesus Christ could take a self-absorbed, angry young man and turn him into something that could actually do some good in society. And Lee Strobel himself, his life was changed, and he too became a believer from that story. Here's my point, folks. I'm not a murderer. But I'm a better father because I'm a Christian. And I'm not that good of a father. but I'm better because I'm a Christian. I'm a better husband because I'm a Christian. And I'm not that great of a husband, but I'm better because I'm a Christian. I'm a better person because I'm a Christian. I'm a better pastor. I'm a better everything that I do because I'm a Christian. And I don't want to go back to that other person. The change in life that happens to people who accept Christ and move toward this, through this journey of faith, become different people. That's one of the reasons why I'm a Christian.